This is Anne Rewarty speaking with Jill on the 24th of November. We're going to talk about her father, Seton Lossiter, and life in the Ohari Valley.
The Lossiter family came to Ohari in 1914. They came from Fielding with the six cows. They came on the train, stayed overnight at the Coles, at the hotel that was in the Coles building in Johnsonville, where Kentucky Chicken is now. And then the next day drove the cows over the, what we call the old road, out to the farm, and their belongings were transported by wagon, bullock wagon, I think, Fisher's bullock wagon, or transport. They'd come from Fielding. Dad was the youngest of five, and they went to the Valley School. That was the old school on the lower field at that time. And Dad, after leaving school, well, Dad went to Wellington College as a pupil. All the children, the boys, were educated and went on to college. The girls, they left school, and that was it. No further education for them, for the two of them, which they always resented. But the boys, they walked over the hill to Johnsonville, caught the steam train into town to school. Uncle Philip told me once that if the train was at Takapoo, he had time to sit down and get his shoes from and socks from under a bush and put them on, but if the train was at Glenside, he had to pick them up and run and put them on in the train. And they were so hard up that they just couldn't afford for them to wear these school shoes home and back again. The family were lucky because the farm sort of backed onto the road, came out through the cuttings, so it was, by going overland, it was a much shorter walk than if they'd gone round the road. After school, Dad worked on the farm. His older brothers and his sisters too. When they left school, there was no work for them, so they all were sent to family around the country. Uncle Philip to family down south, Uncle Gordon to family up in Hawke's Bay, Auntie Jean went to a family in Masterton where she met her husband later while cooking for the shearers as part of her work in the farmhouse, the farmer's wife. And Packy, I'm not quite sure what Packy did, she went back to Fielding Way. So Dad had his own contracting business. He did a lot of contract ploughing and horse work, and he had his own team of horses. And during the time, he said he ploughed a lot of Johnsonville, including where the trotting track was, where the first state houses were built. That used to be a trotting track. But he did work for all the farmers around Ohari with his team of horses and plough and whatever, what was needed. And I do remember him, you know, of course they drained the land by hand. He was very good at digging drains. I remember him cleaning out the drains and digging drains for miles to get rid of the swamps. And then he met Mum. Mum came down with Dad's sister Patty. She'd come out from England to look after her brother's children. Her brother's wife had TB. And after she died, Mum worked as a companion for an old lady in Palmerston. And during her holidays, she came down to the valley with Patty, met Dad. They got engaged sometime later. Then Mum went back to England, and it took her 4 years to come back out again before she could raise the passage. She worked her way back to England as nursemaid for the Italian ambassador, and then I think she worked her passage out again as far as Australia, and then came over and married Dad in 1938. all the ships Mum travelled on were sunk in the war, she said, which was quite sad. And I think the Italian ambassador was, she was always very cagey and I think quite disappointed. So obviously he was the enemy during the war. And so they set up farm. When they came, when Dad's father came to the valley, they had 6 cows. I'm not sure how many they had when Dad took over the farm. He bought the farm from Granddad, and Granddad and Totsi retired to Tihoro. And Dad continued to run the farm and do a bit of contracting, I think. It was very hard life, and sometimes he had a farm worker, sometimes he didn't. There was one chap who had several brushes with the law, and one chap who terrified Mum because he hadn't told them that he had epileptic seizures, and until Mum found him having one, and really unnerved her a bit. But they carried on farming. And the twins were born in 1940. In fact, round the farm, a particular plantation was planted. Oh, that one was the same age as the twins. We planted that one when Jill was born, or the year Jill was born. And all these milestones around the farm were dependent on, sort of dated from the time one of us was born, because there were 6 of us. Yes, as soon as we were old enough, we used to go out and help in the shed. Mostly Dad was on his own, so we used to have to go before school. If there were cows that didn't come in, we had to fetch them in, feed the calves, feed the chooks. We had geese at one stage. We even had turkeys at one stage. They were shocking. They kept dying on us. But all the locals, they'd have this fad for raising particular thing. And sheep and turkeys were good. Come Christmas. Yeah. And the geese were easier. And I can remember our first bridge we got was when we sold a whole flock of geese to a Wellington butcher, and he gave Dad the check in one go, which was supposed to be for us kids, but Dad said, well, look, it's enough, let's buy a fridge. Until then, we'd only had the cooler room at the cow shed, and the milk from the cow shed was distributed through a contractor. Well, he had his own run, and it was a proper business. He took the milk from the cooler and he delivered it to houses in the Johnsonville area. And that was that little business was on sold. Granddad had the first license to, I think, sell milk or distribute milk in the Wellington area as a private contractor, and was the last to go. And I can remember Dad had, because they were still selling unpasteurised milk in Wellington, the health department became involved and took Dad to court. And that was, Dad lost that case, and that was when he had to have his milk go through the Wellington Municipal Milk Department. By that time, all the others in the area, Colin Bruce, Best's and Beecher's, I can't remember who else, and Alcox probably were, they were the last dairy farmers to be there. Most of the others had were sheep farmers and had just a house cow or two. I would suspect most of them had house cows during the war and made their own butter, and probably did a little swap between petrol coupons and butter, because that's what you did.
You mentioned Phil Shaw and
Mr. Shaw. Yes, now Mr. Shaw, I think, he milked his cows, and then I think he supplied restaurants, because Mrs. Shaw also did most fabulous baking. And I can remember seeing these trays of probably a dozen or so in rows of fancy small cakes, butterfly cakes and you name it. And I think he supplied the milk and she supplied the baking for these restaurants around town. you know, for afternoon, the nice afternoon teas. And that the Shores lived in the old house. The old house was burnt down. Mrs. Shore was a companion for quite a well-off old lady, and they had a hall out the back of their house. And when she died, she left the house to Mrs. Shore. And something happened in the early days of their marriage, and the house burnt down, so they made a makeshift house in the hall. And it was always quite small. They did major alterations when June must have been mid-40s, I suppose. Until then, they'd lived in, you know, this... it was quite nicely converted, but it was probably not the easiest place to manage. And Mr. Shaw also did mechanical repairs around the district. I can remember he had this old workshop, but he did some major repairs on Dad's car, and he had to take the motor out. So he strung it up in a tree. And much to the locals' amusement, we all went up there to see Mr. Shaw with this car hanging in the tree.
The whole car.
Yes, he just hoisted the whole car up into the tree, hanging from this big branch. Mr. Shaw was a man of many talents, and he also had one of the first... he decanted gas from large cylinders to small cylinders. Must have been LPG, I think. And he had this gas house up the... built specially for it, which we were always told to keep well away from. And they used to bring out all these great big bottles of gas, and he must have decanted them into smaller bottles. So that was a forerunner for things.
I have a selection of tall, narrow...
Yes, tall, narrow bottles. Yes, and whether they were the smaller ones or the bigger ones, I don't know. But when we were growing up, Alcock's cows had to move between their dairy, their cow shed on the O'Hare Valley Road, and they had a lot of more bits of land in Takaral Gorge, so their cows were often on the road. And then Dad bought land up Rifle Range Road, so our cows spent a lot of time on the road going from our farm at the bottom of the school hill to Rifle Range Road, and cars hated getting mixed up in it all. We used to try and string the cows out so that, you know, one car could go through, and after a while, mostly the cows got pretty good about moving over. But it was sort of slow, but it was just accepted of the area. Oh, one of the other families that were the that came were the Clements family. They had milk too, remember? Yeah. Clements at the you know, at the crossroads, just round from the crossroads. Their land was around the cowshed was so low lying, it was underwater most of the winter. They had the creek going through it. It's where the riding stables are now. And the cows, I can remember this mud, the cows just went from, you know, all the lower paddocks, and then they had the hill paddocks, but, you know, outside the dairy, it must have been impossible. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Clements, she and her husband had the a fur shop in Manor Street, and she was such an elegant lady, and there was all this mud. How she coped, I don't know. And much to our children's delight, you could see through the window she had a wonderful grand piano.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't fit with, you know,
but the mud.
Leon, you see, obviously inherited his mother's love for music, as well as he, I think his father bought the farm for him because he wanted to go farming. And they would ask Dad a lot of, you know, I think all the farmers tried to help him. And Dad was very keen to help the others, anybody who was, you know, unsure of things. I would pull their knowledge, because Dad always said that, you know, he'd had so much help from the older farmers when he started out, that he wanted to give that back.
So Leon now has that museum, is it?
Yes, well, he had the music museum out at Pukerua Bay, and then he sold that, but then he couldn't live without his music, so he started again, I think, collecting. So obviously there was the love for music through the family. But as I say, it was, you know, that house must have had quite a high basement, I think. Probably because of the fact that the water sat round there. And I still go past there at the riding stables, you know, and they've got very firm tracks there. But after a lot of rain, you can still see the mud coming through, and I can always remember that sea of mud.
Well, you'd know what it would be like to work with animals in it.
Well, cows just, they do puddle up. And of course, people couldn't afford the concrete that was needed. Of course, Aridson's also, they had a farm. Peter milked the cows. Now, Aridson's from Aridson's bookshop. John was a bit younger than me at primary school. Yes, and they, until O'Hare was opened up for lifestyle blocks, really, that was when I think Aridson's, because a lot of the land out there was in small blocks, and then it had been amalgamated as farmers, but suddenly when it became worth more money to split them up again, people split them up and sold them as the original size blocks.
Like 10 acres?
Well,
there was a minimum you could
sell. Well, there was a minimum they could sell at, but those that had been amalgamated, if they were sort of 3 acres and bits and pieces, they could cut them back to those original size. And I think Aridson's farm was one in particular. It had the place where the house is, then there was a place Mr. Dunbar bought, and then there was a place that down where Mackay's used to live, Bob Dunn lived there. I don't know who's there now. Up behind, there's Purdy's and Sligo's. The farm went round the back. And then you see that Warren Boss has the... there was a little piece there that was sold off. So that must have... No, that was Sligo's. That was another piece of land, a couple, 2 or 3 acres of land that Sligo's was attached to Sligo's house. So somehow or other they were able to cut them off in smaller, you know, to the original... return them to the original size plots.
Yeah.
And that was how Dad bought the place up Rifle Range Road. There were 2 3-acre blocks and then the big one over the, this is, he bought that when Alcox sold out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lifestylers tended to buy the other bits on the Takarau Gorge Road, and Dad just took the pieces that he'd had on Rifle Range Road. And that was where, when he was ploughing the first time, that was where he found several parts of the original road that came down off the old coach road and then went up the original drive to the house Dad built. And then there was a couple of cuttings further down. It must have come out down somewhere near Mexted's house where the Gordons lived. Must have come into Takarau Gorge Road somewhere around there.
Oh, I've never thought of it. Came down and still straight down the hill.
No, there must have been another road going straight down the hill to the crossroads, but that probably was later. But parts of the original road was there, because I can remember Dad found some, when he was ploughing, he found some Maori artefacts too, that I'm not sure who he gave those to.
Yes,
the stone adze and things like that. And we always heard that that big umbrella tree, it was a MacArthur tree, but we heard that it was a beautifully shaped tree, like a huge great umbrella, and we heard it was a sacred Maori tree. Can't see how that worked, but the Maoris felt there was something about it, and they used to go and hang the first of the season's eels in that tree. Mum had the same feeling. She said the children will never come to any harm in that tree, and she was quite happy for them all to play in that tree and do what they like, because she just felt it was a special tree. And when they, when Mum and Dad died, well, I can remember Mum saying that parts of that tree were dying off just before she died.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it's gone now,
it's
which is sad.
I can't think of it, but that's a lovely little story, that one.
Yes, well, Mum coming from sort of countryside England, another, you know, hard up bringing, she was sort of very much the... you know, sort of in tune with nature and just little things like that. And
they had a little bit of feeling.
They, well, I think the early people did. They were conservationists, and they were very sort of cautious, ahead of their time. They worked with nature rather than against it.
They were very close to the land.
They knew the seasons. And they were very close to the land, and they wanted to work with it rather than, bend it to their rule.
Hard enough living with it and fighting it.
Yes.
You
build a road in a straight line, whereas in those days, if they would tend to follow the animal tracks around the side of a hill.
Yeah.
Then go straight through a hill, sort of thing.
Really, we've lost that, haven't we?
We have lost that ability to work with nature a lot. Yeah. I think it's coming back a wee bit now. A lot of people are starting to realise that it's better to work with nature. Yeah. Mum was used to get very upset. She hated sprays, and I can remember her on frosty mornings running around the house saying, this will kill the bugs.
Yeah.
And Dad used to come in frozen from the cow shed and moaning about the cold, and we didn't think much of the cold. But in the end, he recognised that she was right. If they had a mild winter, he had to use a lot more sprays and drenches and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They did the haymaking, getting on to something else of farm life.
Yeah.
We did haymaking with the old stationary press after they moved beyond the haystacks, which I don't remember a lot about. Occasionally they did them, and it was a matter of pride who built that haystack, whether it was straight, whether it fell over, or whether it took on a lean as the hay dried. But Mr. Best and Dad had stationary presses, and they were so heavy. Used to take two horses to pull these, struggle with these things to shift them from paddock to paddock. And then you needed a big team of men. Somebody would deliver the hay to the man who forked it into the press. And then every so often they had to put in a board that was used to separate the bales. And as children, from the time we were very early age, we used to stand at the back of the press, and they would tie the bales with wire, and they'd poke them through in grooves on the boards, poke them through the other side, and we would have to take it round and poke it back between to the next board, and then the person on the right side of the press would be able to tie the bales off, two wires to every bale. And if you forgot to put in the board, then you got a very long bale. And if it was too long and the wires wouldn't stretch, then they just had to repress that one. But, the hay was cut. Of course, you know, there was always horses. It was cut. And then there was a tedder. They used a tedder. And then the rake. And Prue was the only one of us girls who could ever manage that rake with the horse. Pat and I could not get the the rows straight, and Dad used to get so cross, he wouldn't let us do that. But I could manage the sweep, and you went along and you sweep it up with this, sort of a sweep tray thing with, and then we'd take it and dump it. You just tip the sweep up and it would dump this pile of hay for the person stoking the, forking into the press.
Were they just over, you mean, the sweep or?
The sweep, well, it was in the row and you just along, into the row and picked up as much as you could. There was about as wide as, about a metre and a half wide, and the prongs were about, not quite a metre and a half long, and it slid along the ground, and you just sort of got it underneath the row of hay, and you just pushed as much on as you could to fill that sweep up, and then you just delivered it to the press. But yes, and Mum used to make ginger beer, or mostly ginger beer. They seemed to like that. And I can remember the Dad used to dig a hole in the creek or in the bog, and once again the milk dipper, and everybody used to just, if they were thirsty, you'd go and dipper out a glass full of, or a cup full of ginger beer, and that was the drink, and then smokos were delivered from the house. And in those days, some of the big, and it was, long, heavy, tiring days, we would have to start the milking. Dad would come down and help us start, rush down, help us start milking, and we would keep going until we got to the last half dozen cows who kicked. And then Dad would come rushing down and help us and clean up, and then back to the, hay paddock. And sometimes they kept going until it got dark. And they always tried to, I can't remember how. I think they brought the bales in by horse and cart. Dad built a big shed. So after the war, I think I was probably at primary school. And because there was no timber available, he had a number of macrocarpa trees down on our bottom paddock milled. And he used that timber to build this shed, which was cow shed, feeding shed underneath, and the hay storage up above. Colin Bruce already had one, which I think Colin and his father Gilbert built, and Dad always envied that. So he built this thing. It was 90 feet by 30 feet, and so it was a big thing. And we had we did have one barn dance there, possibly two, but I think Dad got a bit worried because the floor started sagging as we started bouncing around, so they put a stop to that. And then we had, after that, we had dances, mostly associated with the Bible class. And then we went down to the hall. But so that would have been sort of late 40s, early 50s, that shed was built. As we were growing up, we had the school and the church and the hall were the social life of the district. And as teenagers, we started these barn dance with a bonfire across the road in McBryant's place. And we had these wonderful barn dances until they got just out-of-towners knew about it, and it just got too big, and the fathers and the police thought it, got their heads together and decided it was probably not a good idea to continue with that one. We also stayed in Mick Bryant's paddock and looked across the road at the hall when dignitaries came during the polio epidemic. And one Christmas party, it must have been when the Santa came down the road on the sledge, and he handed out presents to all the little groups of children lined up along the fence. But our parents worked very hard to keep us away from any stray outsiders from the district during that epidemic.